WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC on the first day of Hanukkah, December 3rd, so early. But here we are. Happy Hanukkah to all our Jewish listeners. But Hanukkah comes this year at a time of rising anti-Semitism and rising physical threats from anti-Semitism. It's just weeks after the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre, of course. Police are investigating as a hate crime the punching of a man wearing Hasidic clothing in Brooklyn, and much more, including the incident at Columbia University's Teachers College last week, in which swastikas and an anti-Jewish slur were spray painted on the office of a professor who has written about the Holocaust, Elizabeth Midlarsky. She was out for a Hanukkah candle lighting last night in front of Columbia's Lowe Library, flanked by many supporters coming together.
I'm very thankful for it. I'm sorry, I'm very thankful that they are coming together like this.
Elizabeth Midlarsky, courtesy of New York One there, almost in tears, being so thankful to the many people who came together last night, and her message to the anti-Semites?
That it's hurtful and unnecessary, totally, and that we're not going to fold. You know, we're going to keep going and be strong.
So let's talk about the Midlarsky case and the context for Hanukkah this year more broadly with Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish News website, The Forward. Hi, Jane. Welcome back to WNYC and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Can you tell our listeners who may not have heard about it what exactly happened, as you understand it, at Professor Midlarsky's office?
As I understand it, last Wednesday afternoon, she and some students went to her office and found it defaced by swastikas painted, or drawn all over. Obviously targeting her as a historian of the Holocaust and as a Jew. And this happening, you know, here in New York at one of the supposedly safest places to be a Jew was obviously extremely disconcerting.
Can you tell us more about her work? Are you familiar with, is she at Teachers College because she teaches aspiring teachers how to teach about the Holocaust? Anything, is it that specific?
I'm sorry, I don't know her specific work. I know that she's been in this space for a very, very long time.
Yeah, she's been teaching there 28 years, from what I've seen in the press. Are you also aware of the Brooklyn punching incident I mentioned? Actually, I heard there have been a few like that fairly recently.
Yes, Brian, and I'm so glad that you mentioned this, because the truth is that we have been overlooking an unfortunate number of incidents in which ultra-Orthodox Jews, particularly in Brooklyn, where there's a high concentration, are being injured, literally assaulted. In this case, I saw a video of a group of men wearing Hasidic garb, you know, very identifiably Jewish, and suddenly a man comes up behind and just slugs this person. And this is not an isolated incident, unfortunately. We've heard of more and more of these. And I think it's kind of easy for liberal Jews to overlook the fact that this is happening. You know, these Jews are quite identifiably Jews, with their hats and their coats and their modest dress and the way they comport themselves on the sidewalk. In the same way that if you saw me walking down that street, you might not realize I'm Jewish, but they are, and they've become targets. And I think it is worrying, and it's something that we really have to address.
It's also not new. I was trying to find out more about this before we went on this morning, and so I Googled Hasidic sucker punch, because that was the phrase I had heard on another news report, that this guy was sucker punched. And you know what came up? An incident from 2013 that had that same language.
It's true. Now, look, you know, we live in a big city, and there are lots of different kinds of people interacting with each other every day. And the majority of those interactions are kind and nonviolent, and sometimes they're not. And we don't know for sure what the motivation is behind this or these other crimes. That's why it's so important for the police to investigate and for the community to be aware of this. But it is not a new development, but I think it is being reported more, and we are certainly becoming more aware of it.
One Hasidic man in Brooklyn who wears that identifiable clothing was on WCBS News saying he's not going out much right now because why risk being a target? That's so infuriating and so sad.
It is. You know, we never thought this was going to happen here in America. You know, I'm calling you from the Anti-Defamation League summit that's going on now. I was just on a program with the historian Deborah Lipstadt and the journalist Brett Stevens. And as we were lining up to go out on the stage, Deborah, who, you know, as we all know, has spent a lifetime dealing with these issues historically and is just about to publish a book on anti-Semitism. But she turned to us and she said, I never thought a few years ago that we really would be having this discussion, but we are.
And a larger context is that so many people feel that way right now. Latinos and Muslims talk about how overt expressions of hostility have increased since Trump was elected. Defacing the African burial ground in Lower Manhattan is also in the news. People feel more of a license. Do police know who hit Professor Midlarsky's office?
I'm sorry, I'm not aware that they do, but I didn't have the chance to check this morning.
And as far as I know, they don't. And so, listeners, anyone from the Columbia University community want to call in and talk about this incident and how it has made you feel or how you're responding? Anyone from any of the Hasidic communities in Brooklyn want to call in and talk about those incidents and how they've made you feel or how you're responding or changing anything? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You're all invited. And for others, have you ever been around an act of anti-Semitic graffiti, let's say, like at Professor Midlarsky's office or worse? I'm curious how, in your experience, the community came together around it. Who wants to talk about dealing with that kind of trauma to an individual and, by extension, trauma to a community and the best responses? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, Teachers College people, Williamsburg Borough Park people, anyone, 212-433-9692. And obviously things like this afflict so many communities, and we've done call-ins on some others many times, as you probably know, and will continue to. But today, for the first day of Hanukkah, let's make it specifically about anti-Semitic acts and how members of the community have coped and responded. 212-433-9692, or maybe you even have some connection to Pittsburgh today. 212-433-9692 on this first day of Hanukkah with the editor of the Jewish news website, The Ford, Jane Eisner. And Jane, anti-Semitism also comes from both left and right. These days, the right-wing anti-Semitism seems to be the kind that's on the rise.
Yes, as far as we know, and certainly from my experience as a journalist, while I have been criticized from the left, the anti-Semitic harassment that many Jewish journalists have experienced in the last couple of years is a different sort. It often uses Holocaust imagery, which obviously is very frightening. And I think many of us see in President Trump and others a quiet, indirect permission given to this kind of sentiment. I'm not saying that the president is an anti-Semite. I'm not saying that he directed any of this, but I do think that his statements, both about Jews and about things like Charlottesville, but also his policies, have at least given the alt-right the feeling that he quietly endorses this. And that is new and troubling.
Let's take a phone call. Deborah in Scarsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, good morning. I was listening to your program with great interest, and I just wanted to share with you a really inspiring experience. I have an 8-year-old, and our synagogue congregation, Kol Ami, in White Plains, had a book club recently for these children with parents. And we read this book called The Christmas Menorah. And I know a lot of my friends struggle with how to discuss these issues with their young children. And I just wanted to share this tool with you and all the other listeners. It's a story about a real-life incident that happened in Billings, Montana, I believe in 1993. Rocks were being thrown through windows that had menorahs in them. And it's about not just the Jews, but African-Americans were being targeted and Native Americans were being targeted, and how the town just came together as a community to fight this. And the comments that came out of these 8-year-old children's mouths, they got so much out of it. It was so moving when we were there yesterday. And I just wanted to share that with everyone. If you're struggling with how to talk about these issues with your young children, this is such a great way to present it. And thank you for having this program today. It means a lot.
Deborah, can you give us any salient quote from an 8-year-old? I'm putting you on the spot, I realize.
That's okay. One little boy stood up and he said, "This book is so important because if this can happen to Jews, this can happen to anyone. We all have to stand together."
Deborah, thank you so much for relaying that. We really appreciate it and appreciate your call. The Christmas Menorah, she said, Jane, did you happen to see that op-ed in the Times today about Hanukkah being a holiday that commemorates sort of an attack by fundamentalist Jews, the Maccabees, against more assimilationist Jews, and the thousands of years ago, and the irony that the reason that Hanukkah got elevated as a holiday to its current status, certainly in this country, when it used to be a minor holiday, is so that the assimilated Jews would have something to do in the Christmas season that wouldn't make their kids feel jealous.
Well, it's true. I think it's important to understand that history. But, you know, a holiday like Hanukkah, which you're right, is not in the calendar year of Jewish observance very important. It's also taken on, I think, a more beneficial role as well. And to kind of build on what Deborah described, I think that it is also being reinterpreted as a time when we can bring light to the world. You know, we're commanded not only to light the menorah for 8 days, but to put it in our windows. And indeed, in Jerusalem, there's a tradition of Jews putting the menorah outside their windows. And that's a very bold thing to do. And it's also a way of saying that our role here is to bring light into a troubled world in the same way that Christmas is about light and Kwanzaa is about light. I don't think there's any coincidence there. Mm-hmm. And I learned a beautiful thing at a teaching from a rabbi this past weekend, and that is when you think about it, a little bit of light will illuminate a room. A little bit of darkness is dissipated. So light is so much more powerful than darkness, and to be able to teach children about that, as the caller described, is really important.
Yehudit in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yehudit.
Hello. So I'm part of the Park Slope Jewish Center, and the after Pittsburgh, we had gatherings for reflection, we had a community vigil, and we were reached out to by Muslim and Christian leaders. And at Union Temple, where they were graffitied, we had the gathering for the Shloshim for the month after Pittsburgh, where again, community leaders shared, and we had some beautiful singing from our cantors. And that is very much a healing experience for us.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that story. Let's go to Laura in Morningside Heights near Columbia Teachers College. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Good morning.
And you want to say?
I wanted to say that when I've lived up in Morningside Heights for 42 years, and I've never seen or heard that kind of, or seen that blatant expression. Lately, I've heard things that I'm a little surprised about that are subtle, that are more like, well, these people or those people, but never anything like this. And it was startling, and it was scary, and it was horrible. But I think and I hope that in this community, there are a lot of people that will come together to say no, as they have to other forms of hatred. So I feel heartened about that. I grew up in Portland, Oregon for part of my life, and there I experienced anti-Semitism. Both blatantly and to some degree, I would call it ignorant anti-Semitism, people who didn't realize they were being anti-Semitic, but they were, like teachers in my high school when they were talking about buying a car and how they were Jewed down on the deal, an expression I had never heard of. I grew up in my early part of my life in New York City in a black neighborhood where I never experienced that. So it's very... It's made me very sad,
Laura,
to see this.
Yeah, thank you. And it's one thing, I guess, on the secular Upper West Side, another thing in the identifiable by people's dress Hasidic community in Brooklyn. So I actually want to go back to our previous caller, who I think is still there. Yehudit, you there? You there still? Yehudit? Oh, I thought she was still there. I guess not. Because Jane Eisner from The Forward, I mean, Yehudit talked about, you know, an individual response to the graffiti at an individual temple. Oh, I think we have Yehudit back now. You there, Yehudit?
Yes, I am.
So you told us, you know, a story of response to an individual attack, but I wonder how you relate to this in sort of an ongoing way.
My father's people were amongst the founders of Reform Judaism, and he taught me that a little anti-Semitism was good for the Jews. And my mother's family was from Eastern Europe. They didn't think anti-Semitism was good for anybody. And so I was brought up feeling safe here. And it's pretty terrifying, the idea, you know, that maybe not so much. And especially, I do believe that the alt-right has been totally emboldened by Trump, and that he plays those tropes. And, you know, saying, oh, I have Jewish grandchildren, mm-hmm. is, as we say, Nourishkeit. It's nonsense. And he really has exacerbated the atmosphere of racism and anti-Semitism in this country.
How do you, and I don't want to linger on Trump in this particular conversation, but the paradox of Trump emboldening the alt-right, which is so anti-Semitic, and at the same time positioning himself as the strongest supporter of Israel.
It's not Zionism he supports. It's not my progressive Zionism. It's a right-wing nationalism in Israel. And yeah, their interests coincide. And Netanyahu, he supports the right in Israel.
Yehudit.
And that's how I see that.
Thank you very much. Oh, tell us one other thing. When you said your grandfather said that a little bit of anti-Semitism,
father,
a little bit of anti-Semitism is good for the Jews. What do you mean by that?
Well, he meant for someone like him who was very assimilated that it helped him remember his Jewish identity. And how he saw it.
There you go. Yehudit, thank you. Thank you very much. Jane Eisner from The Forward, what are you thinking as you hear that exchange?
Well, I think it's fascinating, and you are right to pick up on this. One of the new things that's happening now is we're seeing a dynamic where someone could be perceived to be a philo-Semite and yet also an anti-Semite. And, you know, certainly I think there are ways of describing President Trump in that regard. He doesn't hate all Jews, not at all. His grandchildren are Jewish. And I'm sure that he thinks he is following policies in Israel that are good for Israel and good for the Jews. And yet, as I don't have to repeat again, we have these other worries about him. And it's not only with him. I think that there's this really dangerous dynamic that is happening where even you look at someone like Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, who has had warm relations with Prime Minister Netanyahu and yet has really demonized George Soros in the most, using the most anti-Semitic slurs that one could find. And we have to figure out how to deal with both of these things sometime in the same person.
Amanda in Summit, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So I basically just call, I don't know how much of this has made it out of the news of this part of New Jersey, but we are definitely having an issue here in Summit that they have found swastikas in the bathrooms in the middle school and the high school last week. So it is an active police investigation, and so far they haven't, you know, found a suspect at either school. There is, you know, once the school actually had a meeting with the kids and sort of met with them first before telling the parents, which did obviously not go down very well in the community. And now they've sort of opened it up and they're being way more forthcoming with the information. The town, a section of the town did immediately rally and, you know, passed out flyers that we're not going to stand, you know, for hate. But as a, you know, Jewish mother with a daughter with a recognizably Jewish name, it makes me, you know, nervous to send her to this school. You know, today, obviously, first full day of Hanukkah, and I sent her with guilt that didn't have a picture of a dreidel on it, but instead had a happy donut face because I didn't want someone to pick her out in the lunchroom necessarily, which is sad.
So sad. Jane, did you know about Summit?
I'm sorry that I did not know about that. I think one of the things that we need to do is to really understand that not only are these incidents increasing, but the way we're reporting them is as well. There's no doubt that Jews feel comfortable and feel like they should report these kinds of things. We know that other minorities don't necessarily have the same trust and belief in the law enforcement system, and they may not report hate crimes as frequently. I also just want to say one thing, that even though we have seen this surge of anti-Semitism that was documented in 2017 by both the FBI and the ADL, most of it, the vast, vast majority of it, is vandalism and not violent assaults. And I'm not excusing the vandalism or not saying how horrifying it is. A church that often houses a synagogue a block from my apartment was defaced with swastikas, and the shock of that is just incredible and makes you feel unsafe. But it is a different form of expression than violent and assaults. Now, those are figures from 2017. Obviously, 2018 was different.
And Amanda from Summit, New Jersey, thank you very much for your call. And, of course, Pittsburgh happened, the worst act of violence specifically targeted at Jews in U.S. history. So it's very different in that respect. But I'm glad you brought up what the history had been and relative to other groups, because I think the operational definition of racism for people who really, you know about it is not just hate, but it's hate plus power. And so hate against African Americans has inflicted so much actual harm. Hate against Latinos has inflicted so much actual harm recently, et cetera, et cetera. Jews have been, I think you're making the point, relatively privileged in this country, relatively accepted in this country, even though there are many, many acts of low-level anti-Semitic expression like graffiti. And yet here we are with this punching in Brooklyn, with this and with Pittsburgh. So we don't really know where it's going, but it's still important to have some historical context and not just say all acts of hate have equal consequences, right?
Absolutely, and therefore you need to respond to them differently as well. And I think that's important, and I have been so heartened by the response. You know, one of the callers described an interfaith service to Martha Shloshim, the 30 days after Pittsburgh. Well, the day after Pittsburgh, I attended an extraordinary interfaith service at my synagogue on the Upper West Side, attended by all sorts of people. And I think it is important that for us as Jews to remember that we are still welcomed here. We are admired. We're probably, according to polls, the most admired religious group. We do have resources and to some degree power to combat this scourge. And all of that should make us even more compassionate towards other groups that may not enjoy that those resources.
That's right. And racism doesn't even have to be hate plus power, like I stated it before. It can be bias, unintentional bias plus power equals structural racism. And so, those are conversations that we've had many times on this show and will continue to have in the context of today's conversation about Hanukkah, as we're just about out of time with Jane Eisner, editor of the Jewish news website, The Forward. It's too bad that we're having this conversation on the first day of Hanukkah instead of just saying, woohoo, happy Hanukkah. But it's a different kind of year, right?
Oh, yes, it is. And yet there is something symbolic about it. You know, I think that we also have to put this in the great span of history. You know, there's a joke about how you could describe almost every Jewish holiday in just a few words. You know, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. And for us, this isn't new, and it is something that reminds us of, you know, our precious legacy and our responsibility just to make the world a better place for everybody.
Jane, I want to let you do one more thing here very briefly. Let me just do our legal ID at the top of the hour, 1102. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey public radio. I see you wrote a piece on Saturday, Why George H.W. Bush's Memory is a Blessing in Our Home. Why is it?
Well, I had the privilege of getting to know the former president when I worked at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And we probably don't have time for me to tell the whole story, but I had many interactions with him in early October 2006, when we were bestowing the Liberty Medal on former President Bush and former President Clinton for their joint efforts to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina and the tsunami in Indonesia. And he was an extraordinarily kind man, surprisingly so, in his interactions with me. And I was supposed to conduct a program interviewing his daughter, who had just published a memoir about him. And that was supposed to take place a week and a half after the actual Liberty Medal ceremonies. And the day before, my father died. And so obviously I couldn't do the program. A colleague stepped in. I relayed a message to Doro Bush Cook to try to let her know why I had to abruptly cancel and express my regret. And a few weeks later, I got a condolence note from the former president a very, very personal one, mentioning how much he knew that my sister and I were grieving the loss of our father. And it's just extraordinary, Brian. I have it framed in my apartment. You know, I was not an important person to him in any respect other than a human one. And I think these kinds of stories need to be told and retold, not only to honor his memory, but because he really symbolized a model of decency and graciousness and humanity in his life that we ought to emulate.
Jane Eisner, thank you so much.
My pleasure.